And our next speaker is Nathaniel Test Unit Talbot, who is going to be speaking on the railroad then and now. Okay, Nathaniel Talbot.
I think it's interesting that, as far as I know, I'm the only person that's spoken at every one of these. And the interesting thing is that they let me keep coming back. I've done a lot of different talks, and this one is going to be, I've done some with lots of code, some with a little code. This one's not going to have any, so I'm a little, I'll apologize a little bit that this has kind of turned into the sermon panel, but it is Sunday morning, so we're teaching our 2.5-year-old son. One of the first things we're teaching him is to say thank you, and the only issue is that when he says it, it kind of comes out as chew, and it sounds like he's sneezing, and I'm afraid that he's going to think that the correct response to thank you is actually Gesundheit instead of you're welcome for a while. But one thing I do want to do is to thank several of the people in this room, Dave Thomas and Andy Hunt, wherever he is. Thank you for introducing the rest of the world to a little known language out of Japan. It has improved my life immeasurably. Also, thank you to Matt for spending so much time, wherever he is, spending so much time working on a language that's as much a friend as it is a tool. And also, thank you, David Heinemeier Hansen, for giving me the opportunity to embarrass myself in front of 200 people trying to pronounce your name. I appreciate that. So what about the railroad? I don't know if when David named rails, if he thought about it, but it provides for all kinds of fun name games and cool metaphors, right? The favorite one I've seen lately is steeldriven.org, and a million web browsers now like go to steeldriven.org. But it talks about John Henry, the strongest man working on the rails, which is I just love that. Just the different metaphors that you can draw to the rails. Obviously, rails sort of they've been around for quite a while, and so there's a lot of mythology even built up around them. What I'd like to do this morning is explore a metaphor, and I'm going to do it in 7 points. It was 10 points, but then that I heard that less is less, which is actually means that it's not really less is more. Less is really less, and anyhow, so it's a little confusing. But anyhow, my top 7 thoughts on rails serving the long tail, with apologies to Guy Kawasaki. So analogies are great things. They can really help us gain a better understanding of something complex by relating it to something simpler or more familiar. But as with most everything else, there are good analogies and there are not so good analogies. My boss gave an analogy that our old release process was sort of like a bowl of gravy with chunks floating in it, and you sort of reached in and dug around a little bit in there to find the stuff that you wanted and pull it out, whereas the new one was more like a box of candy where everything was all wrapped up and packaged and ready to go, and you just sort of took the whole box. And I mean, I'll let you decide what you think of that metaphor, but whenever I think about it, the gravy kind of bugs my stomach. But when I started mulling over the similarities between Ruby and Rails and the Transcontinental Railroad, I wasn't really sure how well it would hold together. You know, sometimes you think of a metaphor and it's sort of superficially really nice, but then you dig into it and it sort of falls apart. What actually convinced me that this was a good metaphor was a third player, which is the long tail. And Chris Anderson is the brilliant guy who named the long tail. And as we learned with Ajax, a lot of times it's not so important that you invent something or that you use it. It's much more important that you name it. So what is the long tail? Well, that is certainly a matter of debate, but here's just a simple overview of what people are usually talking about these days when they talk about the long tail. In any given market, say for instance the book market, you usually have a distribution of sales that looks something like this. There's a small set of hits in the body of the curve, and that's where most of the money's made, and everything else is a large set of non-hits along the tail, and most of them are largely unprofitable, at least compared to the hits. The long tail effect happens when, due to changes in the marketplace, the large set of non-hits becomes more important, to the point of equaling or surpassing the importance of the hits. For instance, in books, one of the big marketplace changes has been Amazon recommendations, and this is actually one of the primary examples that Chris Anderson used in his original article. One of the things he talked about was a book on, it was a story about some rock climbers. It was published in 1988 with nothing but modest success. But suddenly in 1998, sales of it went through the roof. And the reason was it got tied through Amazon recommendations to a book published in 1998 that was a hit and had a lot of marketing and things around it. And all of a sudden, through Amazon, fans of the new book found the old book and started buying it and reading it, and then it spread throughout the community. So the thing that really fascinates me about the long tail is how it changes the game. Like an absent-minded professor when he puts flubber on the home team's basketball shoes. Suddenly it's not so bad to be small. As a matter of fact, it's a lot of fun. And another thing that I'll say about the long tail is that the important part of the long tail is not the things being sold. The important part of the long tail, the part that we're really interested in, is the thing that changes the game. So in the mid-1800s, America was almost two separate nations, one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast, separated by rugged, untamed land. California had been growing steadily, and then the gold rush hit, and all of a sudden it wasn't growing anymore. It was exploding. Various businessmen saw the huge potential of connecting the East and the West over land, largely to make it easier to trade between the two, and they eventually convinced the government to finance a great race. One company built from the East, one company built from the West, with both meeting in the middle, and they were paid by the mile in money and land. In 1869, the two tracks were connected at Promontory Summit, Utah, that dot in the middle. And the first transcontinental railroad, which actually, as far as I could find out, was the first transcontinental railroad in the world, it was completed. But it did a lot more than just allow easier trade between the two coasts. And I don't know that the people who originally envisioned it totally understood the effect that it would have. Because all of a sudden, all these points inland that previously it would have taken you weeks, if not months, to get to them via wagon train or stagecoach, or if you were riding really fast. I mean, this is the same route that the Pony Express took. They revolutionized it by taking the travel down to days, right? And so all of a sudden, people who weren't interested in necessarily being completely isolated from civilization, but who were willing to work hard and take some risks, could go out with the Transcontinental Railroad backing them and basically providing them a support network so that they could go out there. So the Transcontinental Railroad was to the real estate of inland America as iTunes is to the music marketplace of today. It enabled people to move away from the hits of the coast to the long tail of the interior, and many jumped at the opportunity. The middle of the country exploded with growth, which, while far from being painless, still allowed a lot of people who never could have imagined owning land or being a business owner to do just that. So, to tie these two things together, with apologies to Jason Fried, who wrote about the Fortune 5 million in July, what do millions of people around the world have in common? They're all very poorly served by the hits in the body of the software tail. How many of us know even 5% of the features that exist in Word? How many of us even know 5% or use 5% of the features in our personal or business finance programs? And how many of us and the people that we end up supporting even are caused great problems by the other 95% of the features that they don't need? I know that I do a lot of tech support, and I'm betting most of the people in this room do a lot of tech support for fathers and mothers and siblings and friends. And, I mean, am I just completely off base, or is the software just really causing problems for people? So it might be something like this guy. Let me plug this in just a second. And the reason we laugh at that is because it's so true. I mean, even we who are like computer geeks, like to the rest of the world, we're like the computer guys. We want to do that to our computers a lot of days. And it's really not the hardware, it's the stupid software. My wife is part of a small co-op that goes and buys produce at wholesale prices at the local farmer market. She just joined recently and had her maiden voyage doing the buying, a responsibility that they trade around between the people in the co-op. And guess how they manage the orders for the co-op? In Excel. And guess how they swap the orders for the co-op? With Excel documents attached to emails. So it's not just a spreadsheet either, right? It has custom views, which I didn't even know Excel had. It has macros, and it has lots of opaque math thrown in, right? Various functions that nobody knows what they do. So after the head of the co-op came over to our house and showed Katie how to use it, a few nights of aggravation ensued as she tried to compile the orders and figure out how the stupid thing worked. The watchword was don't change anything. At one time, somebody tried to change it, and they like removed some columns, right? They had too many people listed, and so they decided to remove some. Well, the thing stopped working. You can't remove columns, really. But the really awful thing about it is that this thing doesn't even do the hard part of the problem. The hard part of the problem is balancing the order, right? All the people submit their orders and say, I want an eighth of this thing, or I want a quarter of this thing, and they have to determine what they can actually buy based on what the demand is for different items. And it doesn't handle that part of the problem. That you still have to do completely by hand. All the thing ends up being is a really complex, really useless piece of graph paper. So this is but one drop in a sea of examples of the same type of difficulty. The hits of software are hits because they'll solve just about any problem you can throw at them, but at what cost? And how smart do you have to be? So what happens when T approaches zero? Thanks to Andy Hunt for his insightful blog post with this subject, because it really did get me thinking. And as Katie struggled with this co-op order, I could feel, you know, that itch that you start to get in your fingers, and that itch that indicates that you're going to be spending some late nights coding? Well, that's when Cooped Up was born, so I'm calling it Cooped Up. And just, you know, some basic software, because they don't really need that much. There's some interesting math as far as balancing the orders, but the basics of this problem are so simple. So what happens when the cost of developing the software approaches T, or when T approaches zero? What happens when it gets a whole lot cheaper to do this stuff. I mean, before Ruby, I don't know that I would have even considered building software for this problem. And before Rails, I don't think I would have started the software, right? With Ruby, I would have thought about it, but with Rails, I have absolutely no excuse. So I don't think as the cost of building software gets cheaper, I don't think it's going to cause a gradual change in the way that we do software and what it means to build software. I think it's going to cause a very large change, and it's going to be a tipping point sort of thing. I sort of think of it as the singularity meets software, if you will. So what's not going to happen? The hits aren't going to go away, but I think they are going to be forced to at least act simpler. See Office 12, for example, and what Microsoft's trying to do with that. I think it's kind of like lipstick on a pig, but I also don't think that users are going to be programming. While I do think it's going to get easier to program, I don't think users want to program. The vast majority of people out there just have absolutely no interest in it. They just have an interest in getting done what they like to do. And also, I just think that programming is not conceptually something, I don't want to say that not everybody can do, because I think that most anybody, if they put their mind to it, can, but it's just there's that threshold there that they're not willing to climb past or ever want to, and so it's just not something they're going to be able to do. I mean, all you have to do is look at the co-op spreadsheet to see the fact that users don't know how to program and that they're not willing to spend the time at it necessary to not stink at it. So here is what is happening before our eyes in the web space thanks to Rails. Developers are spending less time finding technology and more time actually solving problems for users. With less development overhead, it makes more sense to do lots of little, specifically targeted applications rather than large ones that will solve every problem you ever had and make Julian fries. I believe that Rails is currently leading this technical space and defining the way we think about it. And David explained in his talk a lot of the reasons why, so I'll leave that to his talk. So let's go back to my wife for a minute. I know you all don't like talking about her as much as I do, but it's my talk. I would say that she and the rest of the ladies in her co-op are pretty disenfranchised. They have little to no means of affecting the software that they use and no real choices to use something else. I mean, there just aren't other options for them, right? There are literally millions of others like them out there, small business owners, hobbyists, clubs, families, and civic groups. But that's the other more profound thing that I think is changing and will greatly change how our kids think about software. One day, we'll look around and see everybody commissioning software, not just people with lots of money or people who can do it themselves. Tickets to the interior are suddenly affordable, and everybody's buying one. So while my procrastination is legendary, Rails makes it hard not to do things, and I'll bet that when Cooped Up is ready to go, I'm going to have some passionate users on my hands. Suddenly, they have the power to control their own software, and my hope and fear is that they're going to take that and grab onto it and not let go of it. I'm betting that there are things that they, not only that will they passionately like about the software, I bet there are also things that they're going to passionately dislike and let me know about. But the difference is they can actually do something about it. They might passionately hate it, but they can actually talk to somebody and get something changed. Passionately hating something and not being able to do anything about it is a good way to get a big old chip on your shoulder. And there's a lot of people walking around with software-induced chips. So why not hop on the train and seek out better opportunities? Users aren't the only ones who are disenfranchised by the state of software. Talking to developers, we're tired of working on huge projects where we barely seem to make a dent. We're tired of writing software that never gets used, and we're tired of not having the power to create things that will be passionately loved. Rails is also our ticket to the interior, where we can set up shop and start building something different. I mean, am I completely off base here? Okay, because I do not like the state of software, and I get the impression that there are a lot of other people that don't either. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that so much of it up to now has been focused on the body of the software tail. So remember, the long tail really gets interesting when it becomes profitable and when creating for it is a sustainable thing. Obviously, one person or a small group of people will not be able to afford, they can't pay 200 people, they can't pay a 100-person company, they probably can't even pay a 10-person company to create the software that they need. But one or two or three people working together can probably make a very sustainable business out of building software for the long tail. And the first goal is to serve the users, the immediate users that you're targeting, but probably there are other people in that niche that also need similar software that you can also sell to. And there's no reason not to just do it either. You don't need a bunch of money, you don't need a bunch of people, and you don't need expensive tools. The raw materials are basically free, and what you need is time. And that can be scraped out of weekends, it can be scraped out of evenings, until you can actually get to the point where you can make it a sustainable business. Recently, a friend and I, we did an application with Rails, targeting a specific market, and it flopped completely. All due to the market that we were selling into. We didn't realize quite how weird the market was and the fact that basically we couldn't market or sell into it, which makes it really hard to... Yeah. So, but it flopped completely. But relationships were formed while we were building that could grow into something fantastic. And it didn't cost me hardly anything. It cost me time, about 2 weeks spread over 2 or 3 months. 2 weeks of actual focused development time if you add it all together. And anybody can do that. I'm definitely not the only person that can do that. Now, don't go out and neglect all your open source projects. I need those too. But you can probably scrape a little bit more time. And then once you get it going, you can do it full time. So this is really a feasible thing to do. So let's go start a revolution and stop giving excuses. Now, I think there are and will continue to be two kinds of companies serving the long tail of software, gold rushers and homesteaders. The gold rushers are looking to make it big quickly. They're only interested in potentially big ideas, even if they're just starting out with a small target group. The end goal is to get big. How do you know the gold rushers? Well, they might use a lot of exclamation marks. And there might be some other indicators too. I mean, the .com, right? The dot bombs. I can't make this stuff up. Speaking to results, you'll look around in a year or two, and they'll either be gone, they'll have been absorbed, or they'll be a hit themselves, and they won't really be serving the tail anymore. The other kind of company that will serve the tail is the homesteaders. These folks aren't interested in going public or being as famous as Bill Gates. What they're after are smaller things. An opportunity to create something great, but not necessarily great big. Profitability so that they can keep doing what they're passionate about. Flexibility in their life so they can work from wherever they want to, or just to drive a nice car that they don't owe any money on. Some of them will be open to getting bigger if it makes sense, and some of them will be resistant to growing over a certain size. These folks are the homesteaders, the ranchers of the long tail. They're happy to lay claim to some real estate, work it, and do something they're passionate about every day. Beyond the bias I displayed in naming them and picking examples, I'm not going to make any moral judgments about these two types of businesses and the people that choose to pursue them. I think both are feasible ways to work and live, and I'm sure that different folks will prefer one over the other. But as for me, I'm interested in homesteading, building a bunch of small, sustainable businesses that serve niche markets well. I hope a conversation grows up around how to find, build, market, and maintain small, long-tail software businesses. One advantage we have over the ranchers and the farmers of the 1800s is that there's so much more space to lay claim to in software than there ever was in the interior of the United States. So there are already companies out there that are doing homesteading, I think. 37 Signals is the obvious one, but there's also Jaded Pixel doing Shopify, Firewheel Design is doing BlinkCell, and I like your elevator pitch by 30 Second Rule. And I'm not talking about consulting here. I think that a lot of if not most, long-tail businesses will grow out of consulting. But I don't think that users really want consulting. I think they want to own their data, and they want to love their software. But they don't want to manage software businesses. They don't want to run them. So I think I'm really talking about niche businesses, not niche consulting. So I don't know if you're pumped, but I really am. I'm really, really excited about the possibilities that are opening up and continue to grow, it seems like, every day. There's like so much opportunity in the air that it's like you could cut it with a knife. So go build something cool for your mom or your brother or your neighbor or your friend, but not until I'm done with the talk. But this talk isn't really about Rails. It's really about Ruby. A lot of the excitement around Ruby lately has been driven by Rails, and rightly so. But if you're here, I'm going to assume that you know that Ruby is the real power behind Rails. Ruby enables Rails in a way that is difficult to duplicate in other languages. Actually, the guy who does Sales, the first Java knockoff that David put up there, is a very good friend of mine. And in talking to him, you could ask him yourself, and he would tell you that while Sales is really good, I won't say that it couldn't exist. There's a very, very small probability that it could even exist without the things that came out of Rails. And some of that is David's genius, but a lot of it is just the simple ways that Ruby allows you to think that Java does not. You just can't think that simple in Java. But you can duplicate that simple if it already exists. So Rails is about the web. But what about platforms that aren't the web? I'm still waiting for the frameworks that will power the long-tail revolution on things like the desktop or the handheld. Desktop applications will always be with us. You'll pry my NetNewsWire and my TextMate out of my dead, cold fingers. But developing them is too hard. It's a pain. There's too much work to it. So we need frameworks that allow us to build desktop applications as well, as easily as we can build a web application now. And I don't think that those frameworks are going to be written in .NET or Java. I don't think they're going to be written in Perl. I don't even think they're going to be written in Python. I think they're going to come out of Ruby. Obviously, I'm a little biased. But these things are going to come out of dynamic languages. I don't think they're going to come out of Objective-C either. While there are really cool things going on in a lot of those places, I think Ruby's simplicity is going to allow us to create something much better. But who's going to build it? Here's the power of Ruby, the fusion. Ruby is drives the steam that runs the engine, but I think it's going to drive other things. You know, I want to see Ruby Wings or Interstate Ruby, you know? But these frameworks aren't going to grow fully formed out of our heads. They're going to be extracted from real things that we're building as we serve the long tail of software, as we do the smaller things. Because I'm not interested in big honking J2EE frameworks. I'm interested in little small things that let me build very specific applications on top of a more general framework. So don't get boxed into thinking that you have to do this using Rails. It's the best thing I've found for doing web applications. But with Ruby at your fingertips, the possibilities extend far beyond the web. So, what does it all come down to? Just as in the late 1800s, there's opportunity at the other end of the line. So come to the station, grab a boarding pass, and let's get going. There's little to lose and everything to be gained for ourselves and for those for whom we can do great things. See you there.
Questions?
Hi, could you talk a little more about what you mean by users owning their data? Because I'm imagining this scenario where I've built 120 Rails apps for people in my city, and where are these things hosted and how are they in sync? And is it suddenly this ever-growing problem for me to maintain them? Or am I handing these things off to the users and saying, hope you have a free BSD server somewhere, Ma?
What I mean by users owning their data is users want to control it. They want to be able to export it and do what they want to with it. So if you build 128 web applications for people in your city, obviously there's some management that's going to have to go into that as far as, you know, the normal things that we know as far as not duplicating things. But I think that's something that you would host and maintain for those users. But the key thing is that the data is theirs. It's not yours. And we care a lot about the actual, well, I can take all my data away from you. I don't think users care about that as much. Maybe they should, but they don't. What they really care about is, oh, I found this other cool thing over here that I could use the data from your application for, whether it's a replacement for your application or whether it's just a cool remix, right? And they want to be able to take that and do whatever they want to with it. So that's really what I was talking about.
Yeah, I was just wondering, this is a question for almost everyone. How many people actually consider themselves making a living in the long tail right now? And how many, on average, applications are you writing, you know, a month, a year, along those lines?
Five or less. 6 to 15.
So I can't raise my hand on that question at this point. Well, I can in the sense that I'm doing some on the side. I'm not making my main money off of writing for the long tail, but that is a definite goal. It's going to happen.
Hi, my name is Eddie Pasha. You were talking about this big desktop applications like Microsoft Word and Excel. They have so many features. Actually, four months ago, I paid $29 for a diff for Word documents just to find out there's already one within Word. So even I cannot find some features which are there. But I think there's something we should keep in mind. There's two kind of complexity. The one is if you have one application with many features, and the other one is if you start using long tail small applications and then you find yourself dealing with 10, 20, 30, 50 small applications. So there's also a danger in that. So sometime we need to take these applications and make bigger ones out of it. I think there is something to this complexity which we cannot get rid of it because we need some kind of, we are getting more productive even though we feel that the software is getting more complex, but at the same time we're getting more productive. And for that, there should be some amount of feature which is like information. You cannot take music, which is 3 MB, and compress it to 100K. You can compress everything only to a certain amount of point.
So two things. Number one, there's huge long tail possibilities, as with the Word differ, to just build software that makes the hits work better, right? The other thing is, as far as the complexity of having lots of these little things that, you know, do specific things, there's also definitely a space here for the aggregators, right? The filters, the very things that, you know, will allow us to manage, to access these long tail things. And, you know, those may very well be hits. And I'm not saying that the hits are bad by any means. There are some that are very good. I mean, I am glad that Google is a hit because it has made my web experience just searching alone so much better. And I don't think they could be what they are without being a hit. So I don't want to get down on the hits too much. I'm just saying there are huge opportunities for the long tail, and we don't need that many hits. So don't try to build one. Build something small.
Wait. Sorry, I got it over here. This isn't a question as much as a comment. My name is Derek Sivers from CD Baby. And you can actually make a business in the long tail. You know, CD Baby's a good example where we only work with the small little independent musicians that when I started it back in 1998, like, nobody would deal with the musicians that didn't have a record deal because they were only going to sell like 5 or 10 CDs and nobody felt it was worth it. But if you kind of put a whole bunch of people selling 5 or 10 CDs together in one place, you have something that's very worth it. And I can't help but think that, you know, the same could be true with whether it's hosting or, I mean, you know, not everybody here is only going to start a software development company. I mean, there are people doing other interesting things here too as well. And I just think it's really interesting that, you know, by serving the people that aren't getting served, you know, the people that aren't big enough to deal with, you put them all in one place, you've got a real business going.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, and I'll just say, I mean, that's what business should be about, right? Is like serving people that aren't served, as opposed to, well, I'm going to create this huge honking application in order to make lots of money for myself. Well, it's okay to make money. It's okay to want to make money, but the goal should be to get it by actually serving needs, not just in, like, creating them. So, yeah.
This is Kurt Hibbs. I've got another non-question. It's more kind of an observation that I don't have an answer for, but just to throw it out there for people to think about, and maybe you and other people might have a response. A flip side or another aspect to the to taking advantage of the long tail in the ways that you've described. There's an ancillary problem. It's nice that we are being enabled to write software to solve these niche problems in a way that can be profitable. The other side of that is, when there are thousands of these such things out there, is how do you find them as a potential customer? You know, Amazon has solved that problem for their customer base, but you know, maybe this goes along with what Derek just said. You know, maybe there's, you know, somebody needs to pick up and become an aggregator for long tail software solutions of some sort.
Right, and like I said, I'd like to see even more conversation grow up around this, and one big part of that is how to market these things. How do you find your niche? And that, like, we have one aspect of allowing us to build out the long tail, right? The technical aspect of being able to make it sustainable just technically. But there is the need for the filters that will actually target this software to the niches where it fits. And for me, blogs fit that need in a lot of ways. But I'm a technical user and I actually read blogs. Most users don't. So we definitely need more things.
I'm John Leibovitz. I'm totally with you on the commission software and very small tools like the co-op thing. I live in a small town in Oregon, about 8,000 people, and I've been amazed at, although most of these are real early on, how many folks I've talked to who say, I really need my little shop to be able to do this. And I say, I could make you something that would cost you maybe a few $100, but it would be your thing. You know, and they say, great. You know, they don't really care about some big marketplace of these abstract services. I mean, you know, a print shop wants a way to have a file, you know, have users upload their files, you know. And I've actually had great luck so far in at least proposing it. And, you know, maybe it's even easier in a small town than it is in a big city. But, you know, so that's one marketplace, is just wherever you are, you know, talk to the florist down the street. There's a good chance they don't like what they're using. And, you know, a nicer app would do them well.
Yeah, and one thing with that just kind of makes me think about is, when you're talking to that print shop, find out who they know in the printing business. Because they might not be a connector, but in The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell talks about the connectors. Find out who they know, and then go talk to who they know. Because if they're just a small town print shop and they know somebody, that person's probably a connector. And then get that person to start talking about your software for that particular niche that you're serving. That's one potential way to market those.
I just wanted to jump on the non-question bandwagon. Since your talk was about the long tail of software and specifically web applications, at least until the end, I wanted to mention JotSpot. I don't use it myself, but I was following it for a while when it first came out, because that was their mission, to enable the long tail of software within a specific subsection of the spectrum. And it's a pretty cool idea. There's some value there. So I thought that's probably an important footnote for the talk.
Hi, Paul Brannon. You seem to indicate a desire for something like Rails for the desktop. Do you have any ideas abstract or concrete or otherwise for what such a framework might look like? Any thoughts?
I have abstract ideas, but like I said, I'd really like it if somebody else did it, because then I wouldn't have to, and I could just use it. But I really want something that's extracted out of solving a real problem. So while I have abstract ideas that I would apply to creating a desktop application and see what popped out, I don't really have specific targeted stuff at this point.
Kurt Hibbs, I just have a follow-up on that, because I have my ideas on that too, although I gave up on being able to do it personally because my interests shift. But I think Naked Objects has the right idea for the desktop GUI stuff. I think it could be done simpler, especially in Ruby. I even created a RubyForge project at one point called Naked Ruby, posted some stuff, and then I'm way off the mark. I asked them to delete it. But I think something along those lines could become the rails of the desktop side if it was done correctly.
Hi, Eric Promislow with another non-question. I was a real fervent user of something that we could call Rails for the desktop. Apple shipped it in 1987. It was HyperCard, and I really feel it did on the desktop what Rails does on the web. So there's been a Python card initiative that's been in like 0.1 for years, and I've just been sketching and wondering, could it be easy in Ruby? Could it happen? Could we, solve the mistakes that Apple made? But that was a real enabler. Non-programmers were whipping up all kinds of little apps.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
And obviously, you can do cool things with it since they did the original Mist in color HyperCard.
That's right.
Just amazing.
Yep. And secondly, your talk reminded me of a paper I stumbled across yesterday by David Stutz. Is he here by any chance? He was one of the guys who wrote Rotor, which was the BSD-based .NET framework at Microsoft. He shipped that in 2001 and then quit, mainly to raise wine and live on his farm and write interesting papers. So I won't give you the URL because his site is called synthesist.net, but if you search for the natural history of software platforms, you'll see some ideas that you touched on as well. And Ruby could be the disruptive platform on the desktop.
Cool. I love this. I mean, I actually kind of figured that more of the questions would be more interesting discussion, and I like that. It's great.
I thought you were going to say, I really thought the questions would be more interesting.
No. No. No, these are very interesting.
Other questions for Nathaniel? Okay, thank you very much.